Hey there. You know, if you're a frequent listener to our show, you already know that our show is brought to you by our friends over at Artillery Sports. But what you may not know is that Artillery Sports helps athletes of all types win on and off the course and court. They do this by selling quality, durable, and precision manufactured sports equipment that keeps you in the game, while also using a portion of the profits to provide the funding needed to care for our nation's veterans. With Artillery Sports, it's more than just a game. So head over to artillerysports.com today to buy the quality equipment you need to keep you in the game and to help our nation's veterans at the same time. That's artillerysports.com. Make sure you head on over there today. Oh, and use the code DOCFIRST to get 10% off your first order.
I never do this. I never push record from the beginning. But I don't want to miss a second of my time with you. And I apologize. I said I was not going to do this, but I already am. I'm so emotional. I'm so happy to meet you. I cannot even stand it. I have been a fan since I was in high school. So I didn't want to say this until I got here, you know, or tell anybody, but I've just been overwhelmed with the thought of meeting you to just tell you thank you for everything that you have done. I am really speechless. I don't know how I'm going to get through this podcast. You helped me get through high school, you and your band. And I'm from Long Island. I was there in the 80s. So I followed y'all's career ever since I was like 13. So this is an interview of a lifetime for me.
Aww.
When it came across my desk, I just couldn't say yes fast enough. So I'm sorry for crying and
that's all right.
Yes, totally sorry for fangirling. I'll get myself together, but I wanted to get that out of the way so that I could have a really good interview and focus on you.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, you know, look, I mean, this has been an amazing journey for me. You know, I met Bill in 1974. We started working in 1974 and like that is, you know, it's defined most of my life. I mean,
How old were you?
Well, I was 20. I was just about to turn 21 and he was 25. Piano Man, I think, had just come out maybe 6 months before then. And I started a lighting company out in California and cold called a bunch of bands. And this was, you know, this was when the rock and roll touring industry was very, 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 very primitive and very young. And, you know, we basically made this stuff up as we went along. And Bill and I met and we developed a relationship. And I learned a lot of my work ethic from you know, him and from us, you know, just showing up and doing the deal. And, you know, in November of 1974, I remember I did my first show with him and it was in a field house in Milwaukee. And at the time, I think the record was Street Life Serenade, and the show opened up with a song called Street Life Serenade, or Street Life Serenader. And I did the show. We finished the show. I was loading out. The band was gone. I think I probably had 15 conversations with him. And the sound engineer came back and he said, Billy wants to see you. And I was like, I thought I was fired. I mean, I'm like thinking, that's it. You know, it's the end. And we were staying at a Holiday Inn not far from downtown. And it was one of those Holiday Inn courtyards with the pool in the center. Yeah. And I got out of the car and they were sitting around the pool. And there was a bottle of vodka and a bottle of Kahlua sitting on the table. And Bill says to me, you want a drink? And I said, sure. He says, well, we're drinking Black Russian. So he mixes vodka and Kahlua and he hands it to me. And I'm just waiting for the hammer to drop. And he says, well, Steve, he says, we've just been sitting here trying to figure it out. The song list was the same. The sound was the same. The band's the same. But the audience reacted in places that they've never, ever reacted before. But through a process of elimination, we figured out it must have been the lighting.
Wow.
He said, so here, welcome to the band. And I never looked back, you know, and I never looked back. And I have to say that, you know, from that point on, I sort of got a belief of like what this thing was about, that I was on stage just as much as they were. Mm-hmm. But my responsibility was to take what they were doing and give it to you guys in the audience. And he trusted me. What can I say? He trusted me. So that's, you know, that's 51 years ago.
That's mind blowing. It's mind blowing. You know, we've jumped in here, and this is why I started record because I just knew I didn't want to miss a second, but I need to go back to the beginning and say, welcome everybody to Documentary First. This is a Documentary First podcast where we talk about documentaries. I don't even remember the beginning of my documentary podcast anymore. I'm so overcome. I'm fangirling because we are here talking to Steve Cohen, and we just hit the big time right now. We are to me, it's just Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I just can't thank you enough for being on our podcast today. We're talking about your new film. You're the executive producer of Billy Joel and So It Goes, a documentary that just premiered at Tribeca. But we're going to just talk about a whole host of things. I watched on a plane not long ago another one that you were the executive producer of. I think it was called Turn the Lights Back On. And it was just the concert tour, right? Of the, was it the 100th?
You're talking about the 100th show at Madison Square Garden.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, we filmed the 100th show at Madison Square Garden. Turn the Lights Back On was the new single, but
yes.
that was the culmination of, you know, 100 shows at Madison Square Garden, which I had the honor of being the EP on that and the lighting designer, and you know, won a little piece of hardware, an Emmy for it. Actually, the show won 3 Emmys, and it's been a great couple of years, you know. I think that the thing that stands out to me now is, now that this incredible project is, you know, given birth, and Susan Lacy and Jessica Levin's film is now going to be out for everyone to watch. There's this, kind of sigh of relief and sort of anticipation of how it's going to be received. There's a little bit of bittersweet because Bill, as we know, has decided to take some time off for his health. So our touring world is sort of wound down for a while, which has always been a great part of my life. So, you know, life is a very interesting thing. It gives you challenges, and the best part about it now is that I've had some time to reflect on you know, all these years of working with him, and then I have a document that everybody gets to see to sort of get a feel of what our life was like and all of that stuff. Because basically this film, as much as it's about Billy, tracks my career, because, you know, I've been there all the way through with him. So
what's so great is that we got to learn about all of you. You know, I was thinking about this as I was watching this. And let me just tell you, everybody, first of all, it doesn't come out until July 18th. So I don't know when you're listening to this, but today is June 26th when we're recording. And we're going to try to drop this really quickly because we want to get you excited for the release of this. It is a 2-part documentary series. And I'm going to warn you, it is 5 hours long, right?
Yeah.
So, but I would never, ever have known it. Because if you were a Billy Joel fan, I got up one time to go to the bathroom, and that was in between the parts. And let me tell you, I started it, I don't know what time I started it, but I finished it at 2 a.m. Wow. Because I didn't get it. I didn't get it until late last night.
Right.
And I was like, I knew I had to watch it for today. I was not going to interview you. And I didn't read a single review because I wasn't going to do that. I wanted to watch it myself. And I wanted to see what I wanted to just take it all in and see what I thought and what I felt. And what was just wonderful about it was that I got to know you for real. You know, I mean, not only did I hear your story from when you were young, but I got to see you in an interview. I mean, you were so articulate and just told the story so well because you've known Billy. I mean, gosh, since you were kids.
Yeah.
You were kids.
Oh, I mean, listen, we grew up together, and, you know, yeah. I mean, he had already, when I first started to work with him, he'd already, you know, been as you saw in the film, a very active musician from the time he was his teens. And, you know, he had, you know, from the time he was in the Hassles and Attila and, you know, the first record, which, you know, I didn't meet up with him until after Piano Man came out, but, But, you know, it's still you compress it over 51 years. It's been quite a journey. So you liked it. You enjoyed the film.
Oh my gosh. I mean, really, I couldn't stop. I was on the edge of my seat and I was trying to figure out, I mean, I couldn't even go to sleep after 2 a.m. after watching it. And then I woke up this morning and I realized I was singing the songs in my sleep. Great. Because I woke up and they were still in my head. But it wasn't just that. It was all the images. And I was trying to think about, I mean, I've loved Billy Joel, not because necessarily of his music, but I mean, I've sung in choirs, I've taken piano. And so I love music to begin with. And I have always found him to be one of the greatest underrated musicians of all time. I felt like he is a genius. And I've never really understood why, because I didn't know his whole story. Right. But I, as a, you know, musically inclined person, would hear him and I would be like, oh my gosh, those transitions and the way that he moves things together and the way that he brings all these different musical pieces. And how does he do that? Right. And then I could just feel that music, you know, and I just didn't understand how he did it. And so what was so great about all of this, and listen, I listen to Sirius XM, the Billy Joel channel, every single time it comes on. So this is similar to that. So if you listen to the Billy Joel channel, it's very similar to that, but like on steroids. And so, you know, how his music, like, it just is so, it weaves everything together so seamlessly, and how it just is this like melting pot of melodies. And it's just this big Afghan of everything woven together.
And I love it.
Yeah. Well, so was the film.
I want to, you know, I mean, not to cut you off, but like, it's really important when I talk to you and when I talk about this film to kind of set the table, because yeah. I want people that watch this film to understand a little bit of the evolution. My role in all of this is important, but my role was a collaborative role. One of the things about Billy that has been a through line in our relationship is that, you know, we always, we very seldom take credit for things. And this is kind of, this sounds kind of weird, but
you're so humble. All of you,
You know, Bill always told me, he says, you know, it's not for you to call yourself an artist. Let someone else call you an artist. We just show up and work.
Yeah.
And one of the things, you know, about this film, because throughout the past, I would say the past 10 or 12 years, there have been quite a few people that have come up and wanted to make a film about Billy, and especially at this point in his career. And because my role is, I'm the creative director, all of the television and film projects end up going across my desk because he trusts me to be the visual guy and be able to sort of speak that language that he doesn't speak. And there were a lot of opportunities to do this, but they were all opportunities where it was like, hey, Bill, why don't you tell your story? And Billy said, quite boldly from the beginning, is I don't want to talk about myself anymore. Mm-hmm. All of my life is in my music. Yeah. Like, if someone wants to take the time to go in and tell the story, that's fine. But I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to do interviews about it. I'm, you know, there's all this archive out here. You know, put it together, find somebody who can find a story and be done with it, because it needs to be independent. I just don't want to have anything to do with it. So for me, you know, that's a daunting task, because it's much easier if the artist is paying for it and you put the team together.
Yeah.
So what happened was, and this is a real interesting story, is that Susan Lacey, who started American Masters, which was a groundbreaking show on PBS that she did for 30 years. And yeah. You know, she was a documentary filmmaker par excellence, but basically her through line is the brilliance of artistry and bringing those artists to life. So she had this, you know, incredible history of cherishing artists' stories and telling their stories through public broadcast. It turns out she lives in Sag Harbor. I live in East Hampton. We're on the East End.
Oh my gosh.
She finds me. She knows I have a relationship with Billy. She knows I work with Billy. Didn't know exactly the details of it. And she said, why don't you come over and we'll have a conversation. We sat down, 3.5 hours went by like that. And we immediately bonded. And I walked away going, wow, if there's a chance to make a film, she'd be a really good person to make the film. But knowing in the back of my head that we were not in, we weren't planning to make a movie. We were in the middle of the Madison Square Garden run. The story hadn't been written yet. It wasn't over. It didn't have a little bow to tie it up in. So I left, you know, with this thing, and I reported back to Bill. I said, you know, we have, and he lives in Sag Harbor as well. I said, we have someone in town that's like pretty amazing. And, you know, if we decide to do it, he said, okay, well, we'll put that in the, you know, in the thought process. Fast forward to Sony approaches her about doing a Billy Joel documentary, and she reaches out to me, and I'm like, I don't know what's happening because there were no plans. And then eventually what happened was...
What year is this? What year are we talking?
This is 2000. This is four and a half years ago. So Todd Milner and Sean Hayes, who are friends of the Billy Joel organization, Sean's been a friend of Billy Joel.
Is this Sean Hayes, Sean Hayes?
Sean Hayes. Yes.
After Sean Hayes.
And his partner, Todd.
I would have never put them together.
Well, they're both producers, and they both produce, you know, television, comedy, animated stuff. And Todd and I had a friendship, and we had a lunch out in LA, and he said, let's do something with Billy. We have a scripted idea. I said, well, what else do you have as an idea? He says, well, what about doing a documentary? And I said, well, there's no plan to do a documentary, but if you got an idea on a take on a documentary, as long as it's independent, come up with it. So he gives me a one sheet. I read the one sheet, I send it to Billy, and Billy says, yeah, why not? So the way I talk about it, it's like the music stopped, you know, like everybody was dancing around, and then all of a sudden, okay, now is the time. So about 2 weeks later, Todd calls me up, and he said, would you be interested in having Tom Hanks and Gary Getzman as executive producers involved in this film? And I said, oh, well, I don't know. Let me think about that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, what is their resume?
Are you kidding? He said, well, they'd love to be involved, but they have a choice of a director. Mm. And I said, oh, who is it? Well, it's a woman. I said, wait a minute. And it turns out that Gary and Tom wanted to be involved as long as Susan Lacy would direct.
Oh, wow. So
it was sort of like, I called Susan. I said, I don't know, it's in the water here. And Susan had an all-around deal at HBO, which when we started to talk about this, we realized, well, wait a minute, Tom Hanks, Gary Getzman, Sean Hayes, Todd Milner, Susan Lacy, HBO. This means that A, the film will get made. B, yeah, it'll get made at a level that is commiserate to Billy. And see, it's independent.
Distribution too.
Right? It's a story that we don't have any, that we have to do it. So I went back to Bill and I said, you know, this is the way to do this, but you got to understand something. If you say yes to this, there ain't no editorial involvement. Like, you got to trust these people to tell the story. And he looked at me and he said, what have I got to hide? Quote unquote. He said, what have I got to hide? It's all been out there. Tell the story honestly. So my role in all of this it has really been to take this huge pile of institutional memory, all of these histories, put them in front of these filmmakers. And of course, Susan Lacy then brought in Jessica Levin as a producer, then made her co-director. Then it was really the two of them. And my role in all of this was facilitating, making sure the interviews would happen, do the job of being an executive producer, but at the same time, shine a light into corners and corridors that I only knew because of my experience.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, the experience for me has been so incredible because there were two separate people here. Susan Lacy, who really was a Billy Joel fan, but didn't know Billy Joel. Like, Billy wasn't in her DNA. And Jessica Levin, who's a crazy sick Billy Joel fan, who knows more obscure Billy Joel minutiae than even I do, as the co-director. So we had this wealth of knowledgeable energy to discover and tell this story. And the other point that Billy made whenever any question would come up was it's all in the music. If you bring it back to the music, then that will tell you the story of my life. And what Susan Lacy and Jessica have done in this film that I know you saw, that I'm excited for people to see, is show the audience that all of Billy's life experiences are filtered through the music, which is why 18,000 people stand up and sing every word of these songs, because he speaks our language. He doesn't talk in metaphor and simile. He talks like, you know, there's a line in the film where he says, I write like I talk, I write like I think. And I think that that has been, you know, the through line in why a guy who stops writing 25, 30 years ago, the songs are still as vibrant and vital and important and resonant as they were when they first came out. Even more so, I think. I think history has really done a really big service to Billy's catalog, because in a great way, and I think the film shows this, he was a little bit before his time.
He was, you know, but this is what I thought. He was an old soul.
Yeah.
He was an old soul back then when he was young.
Yeah.
And he just grew into it. And so now, you know, in his late 70s, now he's arrived, you know, he's arrived. Well,
you know, I think the critics, he swam upstream with critics for a very long time. And Bruce Springsteen, you know, says it in the film. He says, you know, at the time, you know, there was a certain rock and roll sensitivity that these rock and roll critics had that Billy didn't play into, because it wasn't, you know, he was Broadway, he was Tin Pan Alley, he was standards. He was, you know, he was writing stories about people's lives in a non sort of poetic-y, you know, what? Even though now, if you listen to these things, the poetry is as deep as anything. But at the time, it was, you know, he got a lot of pushback. So, you know,
he never did what anyone else wanted him to do. He did what he wanted to do. And he says that absolutely clearly in the film. Yeah. And it was what was in him and what was going on in his life and what he saw. You know, there were times where people came in, asked him to do things like, you know, his Vietnam buddies, you know, they came and asked him to do that and then gave him that. But mostly, you know, it's all just about him, and he's going to write what he knows, regardless of what the time is.
Right.
And everything from his experience, whether it's childhood, he's going to put it, you know, if it's, I don't know, the Beach Boys, he's going to put it in the 90s, you know. It doesn't matter, he doesn't care, and that's just what makes it so valuable today.
I think one of the things, you're right, and I think one of the things that I so respect about Susan and Jessica's work is that, you know, Susan loves classical music. She comes from a classical family. So realizing that Billy Joel's, you know, upbringing is all based in classical music, that gave her a focus for her to uncover, you know, that side of Billy. And, you know, also his history and his relationship with his father and the Holocaust story that you see in part two, which is a part of his life that most people don't know. Susan had a very equal, relatable thing, because that's her story as well. Her family were tragically involved in, you know, they were Holocaust survivors. So I think, you know, I think it took a particular type of filmmaker to be able to weave those very powerful life stories into the narrative of a songwriter. And I think, I believe that what they have done is give the Billy Joel fan a layer of knowledge and understanding of his work that you probably didn't know even as a Billy Joel fan. But to the uninitiated, to the person who's like, yeah, Billy Joel, yeah, I got it. Yeah, Billy Joel, right, you know, Just the Way You Are, Uptown Girl, whatever. Those casual fans now realize that there is gravitas in this man's life history that now go back and hear these songs through a completely different manner. And I think great documentary filmmaking, to me, and you're a fan of documentaries, great documentary filmmaking, that is a home run. That's what you want to do. You want to show something about your subject that surprises you, confounds you, and illuminates your understanding of that artist. And we're very fortunate that they were incredibly focused on always pinging this back to the music, always pinging it back to the lyrics, always pinging it back to the classical, you know, roots of those songs. So, you know, I think I think that, you know, timing is everything. Like we are, as Stephen Hyden says, we're 50 years into the Billy Joel career, and Billy has always been the kind of person that didn't want to tell you the inspiration of these songs, because the same reason he didn't like music videos, he wanted you to build this imagination in your head. You know, Christy talks about that in the second part of the film, where, you know, he wanted it to paint the air. He wanted you to visualize this. But at some point, he felt that it's not so precious anymore. It's like, yeah, I fell in love, and that motivated these great love songs. Yes, Just the Way You Are is about a woman. It's about Elizabeth. It's about my first wife. It's not about this thing. And what I really like about this sort of, you know, amorphous fantasy, what I do love about this with in part one, and Elizabeth is a very dear friend of mine. We go back 50 years.
And she's as beautiful as ever. Oh my God.
Oh no, and she, you know, this is a woman who, I have to tell you, after she left and after they divorced, I make a joke, she went into the witness protection program. No one knew anything about her. She disappeared. She wanted to move on and develop her own life.
Did she work? Did she like continue to do?
Oh, she continued to work, but she worked in all kinds of other manners. She was big into philanthropy. She was a counselor, you know, for troubled youth. She invented these products. She had all this other stuff.
So brilliant. Like when I think about, like, I mean, first of all, Billy saw that brilliance in her. And like, I didn't know about their love story and how long that lasted. Yeah. Right. Like I didn't know anything about that.
Well, and it was key to us to tell the story. One of the things I'm most proud about is that I had to get Elizabeth open enough to sit down with Susan Lacy.
You did that?
To be able to communicate. The film couldn't have been made without her. There's no true documentary about Billy Joel's life that doesn't take that. And I knew how much she really didn't want to participate. She didn't want to go into those memories are painful. The memories or for whatever reason, I can't second guess why Elizabeth didn't want to do it, other than the fact that I knew that there was as much negative as there was positive about her. And my feeling about this was I was there. And, you know, I always say there's, you know, three sides to the story. There's his side, her side, and the truth. And what I observed in that time was this amazing collaboration and this partnership that I believe should have been celebrated. Well, you open up that can and suddenly you go, She's Got Away was written, you know, about her. Everybody Loves You Now was written about her. Stiletto, Big Shot, I mean, Just Where like, You Are. You know,
how many albums were written about her?
To me. And if you go through all of those records before Nylon Curtain, there's a through line in their relationship throughout all of this stuff that Billy, you know, was not shy about. But one of the greatest parts about this film, and I think Elizabeth says this line, especially talking about Just the Way You Are, is artists are artists, and they take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and they make magic. And that's exactly what Billy did in the relationships with her and the relationships with everybody else. Obviously, the romantics in all of us, we love to know that their love songs about a specific person. But I know for a fact that many of these songs are conglomerates of many of his relationships, and also an extrapolation of what you believe a relationship wants to be.
Sure. And I mean, just things he sees or stories he hears, or, you know, it's sort of like the Piano Man story where it's based in reality and there are, you know, things and people he meets, but it's not, you know, exactly. It's just stories he weaves together. But, you know, let's go back to Elizabeth, right? What I want to tell you is, as I was watching this, it was key for me to opening up Billy Joel and just drawing me into this story. I did have a connection here because I am a woman that is a divorced mom and I was a single mom. Mm-hmm. And so I remember like these early days of when you're young and there is that relationship there and you're building a family together. And then there's that separation. But recently my son is 35 now and his father and I have reconciled.
Fantastic.
And it has changed my son's life. We've been talking about things. There's been healing. And one thing that I thought was so beautiful, whether it was true or not, but what came through the movie is Billy talks all the time about how he has made so many mistakes, and he's just open about that. It's in all of his music. He's open about it in the interviews, but he says you have to learn from them, right? And you can see throughout that that he does learn from his mistakes, but here he is with people that he has had broken relationships with, but they're in this movie. Mm-hmm. And they are talking about their relationships with him, and they're being open about that in ways that they're being extremely vulnerable. Yeah. They're willing to share. They're sharing those intimate photographs, or they're sharing intimate moments. And for me, that was a testimony, not just to him, but, you know, he talks about how all of his songs are based in people and relationships, not about politics, not about religion, not about the point of view. It's about relationships. And so
the line that he says is, if there's a skeleton key in my work, it is my relationships with others.
Yes.
And really, you know, we spend, you know, I love that you're waxing poetic about this, because, you know, we spend our lives going through our lives, but the things that have meaning are our relationships with the people that are in our lives. And I think that's the resonance of Billy's music and his lyrics, even the classical stuff, that they are reflections of relationships. They're not the other. They're real, and they're based in reality and based in real relationships, which is why you resonate. You know, I used to say, you know, Billy and I, you know, we kind of look alike, you know, we're bald. Whatever, you know, we're like average guys.
We have a little bit of that, you know, Long Island accent.
Well, you know, it's, I always say Billy and I, it's like, you know, when you have a dog, you start to look like your dog. Like I'm just, you know, like I'm his pet. But it's this thing that when we were playing all of these shows at Madison Square Garden, and I'd be out at the front of house and calling the lighting cues and doing what I do. And I would take my headsets off and I would look around and I would see the looks on these guys' faces, not so much the women, but the guys' faces, who would be singing at the top of their lungs at that stage. And all I thought about was, like, when you go into the shower and you sing, you think that you are singing like Billy Joel or like Frank Sinatra or like whatever. Yeah. These are these guys who are looking at a guy who's an average, schlubby guy, you know, sitting there playing the piano. So not only do you sound like him in your own mind, but you think you're him. It becomes this accessible relationship between you and him, which suddenly means that you own that material like he does. And there is nothing, it's no longer an observation of an audience watching a performer. It's an audience being involved in that communication. And when we came back after COVID, because we were gone for a year, we walked into the Garden, we played that show right after COVID, and we all cried for 2 hours. We couldn't stop. It was such an emotional, thing, because you miss that communication with people. And Bill has been able to write this music that is sort of a gateway to all of those emotions. So I, you know, listen, I'm the happiest guy on the planet to have this in my life. And now for you guys to see this from the honest, you know, when Billy said, I don't want to do any interviews, take it off, make the movie all out of archives. And Susan was like, she would talk to me and she'd go, you know, that's not going to work. And I was like, well, I don't know how you're going to convince him. And she was like, put me in a room, coach. And so I then, as you know, cajoled.
Just sitting next to the piano. I mean, that's.
You know, well, that was the other thing that she had said. She said, we have to put him by the piano. Every interview with Billy will be by a piano. And I said, that instinctually is correct, because that's his security blanket. That's his comfort.
You said that. Didn't you say that?
Yeah. That's his comfort.
I love that line, because you, what I loved about that line when you said that, was that for me was like, you knew him. Like, you knew him. Like, you were like his parent, you know, you knew him that intimately.
We're like brothers, you know.
Yeah. Like, this is his security blanket. I know how to get him in a, you know, he just goes and sits there. This is his blanket. Just sit him right there, you know.
And then what happened was, and this is what's so interesting, is that he was supposed to do, you know, when she set this up, she said, look, I need to be able to sit with him at least three or four times. And I said, well, I have a feeling you're going to need more than that, but let's start with three or four. And every interview, he got a little bit more open. You know, he got a little bit more, you know, she got him to go deeper. The other thing that you'll know, and this is a little bit of inside baseball, the first interview we did in Florida in his house. And there was a lot of distractions. The kids were in the other room and all of that other stuff. And I said to Susan, I said, let's do these interviews somewhere else. So most of the other interviews were done at my house. And I have two places. I have a place in East Hampton and a place in Boca Raton. And I have a piano in both. And he lives in Boca and he also lives in, you know, in the East End. So the next four interviews, with the exception of one that we did at Susan's house, were at my house. So Billy walked in immediately feeling like, oh, okay, I'm at Steve's house. So I'm already more comfortable. I don't have the distractions. And that part of my contribution to the film was like delivering an environment for Susan to be able to make him be able to open up. And it was sort of like a 1-2 punch. Like, he was comfortable and she would get him, and he was comfortable and she would get him. And by the last interview, which I believe the last interview, I can't remember the subject about it. I think it was in the film, it's when he talks about And So It Goes, which I think was the last interview. Mm-hmm. There was a sense of really going deep and a sense of relief. And she got that out of him. And after he got through, he looked at her, he said, boy, you get me to go places that I don't normally go. So what ended up happening was he thought it would be a film about archives and history, and really it's not. It's him, him telling us how all of these things work. So I think Susan was incredibly clever about
that. I mean, that's what's so beautiful. I mean, people that are listening to this, if you are wanting to be a documentary filmmaker, a director, and, you know, whatever, a writer, what you have to hear in her work is that it is relationship. Yeah. And like you're talking about, it's creating that space where your interviewee feels comfortable, and it's creating that relationship. You know, I learned in my documentary from this Frenchman who, you know, mine's a World War II documentary. Right. And, you know, I went and I watched him, and he knew so much about these World War II veterans that they began to feel like he was their battle buddy. And so they began to talk to him like they were, you know, he knew they were in a foxhole with him. Yeah. And I was like, man, that's how it's done. Yeah. And so that's what she did with him. You know, she learned, she knew, and she sat with him and made him comfortable. And you could feel that by the end, you know?
Yeah. And what ended up happening, which was so great about their collaboration, both Susan and Jessica's, was that, you know, she got this material, and then you have this co-director who has this unbelievable wealth and depth of knowledge of the catalog and of the Billy Joel story that wove all of these, you know, narratives in through the materials. You know, Susan, I learned a lot, obviously, from her. You know, she lives and dies by transcripts. And, you know, every single interview, the transcripts are all printed out. And if you go into her studio, you'll see stacks and stacks with
paper
of paper where she will take lines of dialogue from 4 or 5 different interviews and then be able to weave together a narrative scene. You know, these days the technology is so available, and you know this, that you can now, you know, you can Google search a word and a phrase. Yeah. So if you're trying to get an emotional moment together in this film, you can access that information.
Yeah, you put it in like Avid and you say, I want hair or whatever.
And you get all of them, you know. Yeah. And it was great to watch that process. So you know.
But, you know, here's what I want to say. Before I lose this, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I don't lose this. Here's what was so impactful for me. as I'm thinking about this. I want to go back to the Afghan, right? That just came out because he did so much was woven together. And you're talking about how both of them brought their skills to the table and wove stuff together, whether it was what people said or whether it was archival material. And what I loved about what they did was it was not linear in any way. This story was not really linear in any way. I loved how they began it. I love how they ended it. You know, it was just brilliant how they ended it with him, I think, in Madison Square Garden, about ready to sing Piano Man, I think. And then it went to like his very first audition, maybe, of Piano Man. And then, you know, you hear him sing it there, and then it ends with him at Madison Square Garden. Oh my gosh, that was genius. Yeah. And then, but there's that kind of genius all throughout it with how they decide to weave his moments together like that, right? It's incredible knitting together. But the what they do is it's not really about the songs necessarily. It's really about the emotions and the stories that we can relate to. Right. So not only what Billy went through, but what the people in his life went through, his ex-wives or his children or his bandmates. Like, I mean, I want to get back to the bandmates. That's something I want to hop to next. I mean, listening to what the bandmates went through or the producers went through who were in these deep relationships with him, right? You're grieving with them. And then you're all of a sudden relating it to your own life. And so he is this emotionally accessible thing. And you know what? You're learning from him.
Right.
So you're learning as he's learning. So you're learning from his own mistakes. So it's not just this documentary that you're just getting information from, right? And it's the same with his songs. I mean, this is what is so incredible about this man. And here's the thing, Steve, this is why I wanted to meet you. He surrounded himself with people just like that. And your instrument was not a piano. Yours began with lighting, but it has expanded into so many other things. I mean, you took all this institutional knowledge that you had and you figured out how to weave it together. And you used the people in his life and everything you used like a piano or like a lighting kit, you know, to help make it. And so then we're learning. You know what I learned?
What?
I have the same sort of dysfunction in my family that he does. Like with I don't hope my mother doesn't listen to this, but like mothers or grandmothers that have emotional things and I have emotional things and just stories like that, where what I loved about how you portrayed those difficulties emotionally in families was he didn't diss or completely unpack all the negative stuff, but he was real. You know, he was real about these pains were here and they affected me, but there's still that love there. And you guys did that in a beautiful way. And so we're learning from him. And so that's genius.
And that's genius. Honestly, I could have kept talking to Steve for hours. Well, and let's be real, I basically did because we have part two coming up. But I mean, man, how amazing was that? That Steve created a space where Billy Joel could open up and how Susan and Jessica wove it all together. I mean, it just knocked me out. I mean, obviously you can tell. This wasn't just a documentary though about music. It was about heart and healing and human connection. It's just so much to learn from in this documentary. I really encourage you to watch it. Now, in part two, we dig into Steve's own journey, his career, his creativity, and how he became part of Billy Joel's inner circle. So don't go far. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody. Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.